Good evening, readers and writers, and welcome to the first January 2021 edition of Page Turner Podcast. I'm your host, Kari Cooper, and with me, as always, is the great Rob Roy McCandless.
Thanks, Kari. And I would like to introduce everyone to our guest author today, Mara Wilson. After a successful career being other people and later teaching others the many tricks of the trade, Mara Wilson has decided to be herself for a while, and it turns out she's a writer and a publisher. She's actually my publisher, which means I love her doubly. She's always loved stories, especially fantasy, mystery, and sci-fi. Mara was born in the year of the dragon, and I love this, has a dragon-themed room in her home, but sadly no actual dragons in the backyard. Mara opened a small publishing house in 2014, the wonderful Elysian Press, where she is the senior partner and editor specializing in speculative fiction. Elysian currently has over 20 authors, I'm one of those, with whose books have garnered more than a dozen awards. Wow. Mara's own books include, I love this, her memoir, we will definitely talk about this, The Other Side of Philip K. Dick, a look back on their 10-year friendship, her new take on the zombie genre, Apocalypta Z. Also, and this is the books that we read, Modern Magic series, A Look at What Would Happen If Magic Were to Return to Earth. The series includes Relics, Portals, and Magic. Mara, welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much for having me. I appreciate it.
First of all, I want to hear about this dragon-themed room you have.
Well, it's my family room, but like, I have a dragon table, a dragon lamp, dragons on the wall, dragons hanging from the ceiling, dragon chimes, dragon candles, dragon daggers.
Wow. Where a dragon table? What's it look like?
Well, it's glass table, but it's actually like a standing lamp, and it's like imagine a post that's about 3 feet tall with the dragon winding around it and up and then the shade on top.
Wow, I'm going to probably need a picture of that, eh? I'm going to need a picture of that. You've got a really interesting resume, Whitmer. Can you tell us a little bit about, it says here, after a successful career of being other people. What does that mean?
That is going back into my acting, which I started when I was 5, started performing, and then went pro after college. On stage in Southern California, and I did 3,000 performances on stage in an 8-year span with that company. And at the same time, I had started teaching as well. And then I just got burned out at 32. You know, I'd done well over 30,000 performances in my life, and I was just done.
30,000 performances.
I mean, 3,000.
Either way, that's a lot. By the time you were 32,
yeah.
And so that, I just was sorry. That stage work.
Yes, primarily. I did a little bit of TV, a little bit of film, but 95% of it was stage.
Wow.
So what would we know? What would young whippersnappers like Kari and myself know?
Nothing. Not unless you were in, we did children's theater during the day, theater for mm-hmm. children, and then at night we did dinner theater, mm-hmm. and I left the company in, 86, around it there.
Yeah.
So, unless you were in school, you know.
Well, I was.
I was in school. But you were doing children's theater during the day. So, like, can you tell us a bit about that? Like, when you say children's theater, what do you mean?
It's theater for children. It was all adults. It was all professional adults. It was all actors. And we traveled around to the schools.
Oh.
And we did, yeah. And we did, we had plays that we did in the repertory. So we had our 6 or 7 by the 6th or 7th year, and then we cycled through them. So the first year was Rumpelstiltskin, and the second one was Simpleton Golden Goose, and then we had Aladdin and Merlin and Pied Piper, and we just did them all in repertory. Plus we were the children's theater company for the city of Brea.
Mm-hmm.
So is this in California?
Yeah, Southern California.
That's really neat because, you know, you hear a lot about how actors and actresses like that are famous today say, oh, you know, I got my inspiration. I saw a play or I saw, you know, so I wonder how many young actors and actresses you inspired with those shows, you know, that you probably don't even know about. You know, you went to their school, you put on this play, that's, you know, they got bitten by the acting bug. So that's really interesting.
Well, thank you. It was fun to do at the time, but it, you know, it did cause some burnout, you know, because we did during the day, we did anywhere from 2 to 4 shows. And then if we were in our dinner theater mode, then we went and either had rehearsal or dinner theater after that. So that made for a long day.
Oh, I couldn't imagine. So you said you stopped doing that in 1986. So once
around then, yeah.
So once you gave that up, what came next?
I went into business and I did that up until 1996, and I was also teaching, so I did both. And then I actually wrote something in 2000, which is a screenplay that's sitting on my hard drive somewhere. And then from that, I've always been a gamer. I've been a gamer since about 2005, and I was playing WoW with these friends of mine, World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And that's where the names from Relics, the Magic series came from.
Of course it is. I knew that I knew them. I just could not. It's my own horrible biases. Like, how could Mare know World of Warcraft? And of course you do. Of course you. I'm so sorry. Of course they're from WoW.
Well, the names aren't from the names
but,
themselves.
But that's
are not
the inspiration.
WoW.
I can see it. I can go. You keep telling the story, but I can see it now.
Well, we were playing, and back then, you know, we had a raid, and back then, everybody who had a Tauren, which Taurens were kind of cow people, mm-hmm. everybody and their brother was calling themselves Moo something.
Yep.
So, and we had this one couple who was Moo. Muthulu and Maleficent.
Yep.
And I was just like, okay, I'm not going to do that. And I'm literally typing the names into chat where I'm going to tell them, I'm just going to call you Thulu and Lafi.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And as I was typing it, the characters just like, oh, no, you're not giving that name to them. Those are our names. And I literally erased the message. Yeah. And within, I think within a day or so, I started writing the first book.
And that's where Thulu Khan and Fiona came from.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lafi. And that's where the Lafi came from.
Right. Yeah. And that's why they called her that because of the teriyaki burger.
Right.
In the book. I love that.
It's a great backstory in the book, but it's so fun to hear that it came out of World of Warcraft, which of course you play.
Well, I wondered if you were a gamer because they were gamers in the book. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I thought, no, there's no way she's a gamer. She's an older lady. There's no way, but you are. Here we go.
You have no idea how old I am. And yes, in fact, in the old days, I used to be a really hardcore gamer. I mean, we were playing 4 hours a night, 4 nights a week, and then doing other stuff the rest of the days. But I mean, we were online and playing. Mm. And our particular grading guild at that time got pretty high up in the rankings. But I can't do that anymore. My hands just don't. I can't
do
that.
For World of Warcraft, why is it so addictive?
Stories, yeah, they've especially the graphics that have come out, you know, over the years. If you go back and you watch the evolution of the game, because you know they started in 2004. I came in right towards the end of the very original one, so I was there for that. Yeah. Yeah, I was there for that transition into the next expansion, and. I went away to Star Wars for 5 years, and then I came back to it about 5 years ago to WoW.
So you
and
still play WoW, Mare? You still play WoW?
Okay. Yes. In fact, when you texted me, I was in WoW.
So Kari and I are like, Well, maybe her dogs took her phone, or
I said maybe her phone fell in the toilet.
I didn't get the phone call. I didn't get a phone call.
And you're gaming. She's gaming. Yeah.
So I was really abrupt, and I'm like, guys, I gotta go.
Oh, that's so funny. That's so funny.
Do you create your own character in WoW, or do you have to pick?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What's your character?
You've got frameworks. I've got all of the characters. You create a class, and you create what you want that class to be race wise. So, you know, it's not like, oh, let me pick the shoe in Monopoly, you know?
Right.
You've got control over how your character looks, what race they are, and then certain races can be different classes, and then other races can't be. So I was really disappointed when the Horde got the Volterra that just came out like the last expansion. So they were really cute.
There's always something.
What's your character that you use?
My main character is Aerith, and I've got several on a bunch of different servers, but this last one is because the guild I'm in is one of the mega guilds. We're in just about every game out there. If there's a game, we've got a chapter in it. So coming back into WoW was nice because I knew people. So I moved from my old guild, and I moved my characters over into the new guild, which was a different server. And it gets a little expensive when you move too many of them. So I didn't do a lot of those. But yeah, I've got like, how many characters do I have? I think I've got like 13 or 14 on this in this server, but because my guild was so active on the Alliance side, I had to start all over with my character and do an Alliance instead of a Horde. So I had to move from the Horde to the Alliance, which most of your listeners are not going to understand.
They're going to be at a loss.
I'm a little bit lost, but I saw the movie. I know this is probably... Yep. Rob's probably kicking me from afar right now, but yes, I saw the movie, so like I understand a little bit about like the Horde, which are the like the orcs or whatever, right?
Right. Orcs, Tauren, trolls, Volterra, and the blood elves. They've got the blood elves.
They have the really cool looking elves. Yeah, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, Mayor, but Alliance has the Void Elves now, so we've got really cool.
That's true. The Void Elves are all. So this is very. Mayor and I are going to start talking WoW here, but
that's okay. Mayor,
how does this inform your writing, Mayor?
I don't know. It caused me to make Thule and Lafitte gamers for sure.
Yeah.
It's my social outlet, especially being under quarantine, because I've been under heavy, heavy quarantine since last March. And I don't go in, but there's a couple stores I will go in, but like not Walmart, you know, I do curbside. So it's my social outlet as well. How much it had to do with the writing? I'm not sure how much came from gaming as an amalgamation of the gaming and the acting and the, you know, then it just sort of segued into writing, I guess. Because, like I said, I wrote that screenplay back in 2000. Well, I wrote it as a stage play musical. It sucked. So I completely dumped it and redid it as a screenplay in 2005. And then in, 2011 is when I wrote Relics.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's everything from then is just, you know, me writing and then creating the press, which I love, which means I'm not writing hardly at all. I don't think I've written anything in like 2 or 3 years now.
Yeah. It's such a balance between having time to write and having time to market your writing.
and trying to edit and publish on top of that. It's right, I'm one person. No, I just can't do it.
Yeah. And tell us about that. Tell us about how you started up Elysian Press and why. Why did you decide to? Yeah.
Yeah, Elysian Press. Yeah, and Elysian. I know we spell it incorrect, but we did that. Okay. We did that because there was an Elysian publishing company.
Okay.
And we wanted the name, but we didn't want to get confused with them. And even though they were defunct, we didn't want to encroach on them. So we just changed the spelling.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's why it's not spelled. But, you know, coming from WoW, I'm just used to people
changing name.
Yeah, we do all sorts of creative things of how to spell things, you know, D-H-O-T-T for dot, you know, yeah. I mean, we get pretty creative with the names. So, but I was with a publisher, I was not happy, and I was learning a lot of what not to do as a publisher. And one of my close friends was an editor, an English professor, and I was teaching college at the time. I was teaching theater and public speaking. And we were talking one day, and she was just going over some of the stuff and just ranting about how badly my book had been edited. And she, you know, I'm like, well, we could do better than this. And she just looked at me, and I looked at her, and we're like, we can do better than this. So I bought my rights back, and that company later on, it wasn't long, it was a few months later, and they ended up closing their doors. But, you know, it's sad because I think their hearts were in the right place. They just didn't do their due diligence. They just didn't want to put the time into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you can't just do that. If you're going to have, in my view, if you're going to have a press like that, you have got to do, your authors have to come first. Obviously the books too, but you've got to take care of your authors. You've got to make sure they know what are the right things to do, what are the wrong things to do. Don't, you know, there's so much information out there that if they look at a lot of it, they like go off down the rabbit hole, literally down the rabbit hole, and you're like, this is not how that works.
So when you get a new writer, so how does it work exactly? And this is going to help our the writers that listen to our show. Tell us a bit about the writing, the publishing process, and how you get these manuscripts, and how you decide who you're going to take on, and who, you know, who you think you can publish, or who, how does that work exactly?
Well, let me preface this with my first partner. She ended up getting ill, and I got a new partner by the name of David A. Gray, who is also one of my other authors, and then Joe Murphy, who has been our cover artist practically since day one, is just joined us this year as our third partner. So there's the three of us. So you keep that in mind in the background. We get queries. We get a letter and we read the query. Usually I don't go much farther than that because I'd rather they look at them first and then because they know what I'm going to like, what I'm not going to like. So Joe and David will take a look at the samples they send in. We require a 10-page sample, a synopsis, and then the query. And I only go into the other stuff after they do if they say, read this. But we did more this last year, but we went about a year and a half, I think, maybe a little bit longer, without signing a contract.
Oh, wow.
So our emphasis is on quality rather than quantity. And the very first criteria is, do I want to read this again?
Okay. Or because, yeah. So that's how you judge, is like, do I want to know what happens on the next page? Kind of thing.
No, that yes. But also keep in mind, I'm going to have to read that book probably 4 or 5 times.
Right.
And if I don't want to read it again, it's not going to get a contract. It's just that simple. And that sounds kind of mean, but you know, you have to draw the line somewhere. And we don't want to get really too big. We'd like our authors to get big, but we don't want the company itself necessarily to get too big and get out of hand. So we do keep the numbers down. for that reason as well, because I've got so many books on queue and they're just all from my current authors.
Right.
So pulling in a new, yeah, pulling in new authors is done very rarely.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a whole business side to it that I've recently learned about, how, you know, these agents have to sell your work. And so a lot of people think that, oh, you know, why can't I find an agent? My stuff is great. Well, it's not that your stuff, maybe your stuff is great, but it's also what's going to be saleable, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that, yeah, but it's very rare our authors have agents. We have a couple with agents, but believe it or not, the authors had submitted on their own to us, so I don't deal with the agents at all.
Right. Okay. So you cut out that middleman.
Yeah. I just, you know what? I had one agent actually email me and tell me to give them a status and a copy of all the notes that I was giving to my author. And I just contacted my author and I said, you might want to tell this person to like back off, because I don't want anything to do with it. And that was my answer to the person, to the agent, was like, I suggest you talk to your client.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't say anything other than that. It was just like, go talk to your client, because I'm not going to deal with you. I wasn't going to have somebody else interfering in the editing process. It just wasn't going to happen.
And do you find that a lot? Like, do you find yourself that your authors are pretty good about the editing process, or do you find that you butt heads with them a lot? Like,
no, I have one or two that, you know, are a little, not quite understanding the process. So they have to kind of be educated. But then I have authors like Rob who are just a joy to work with.
Yeah.
I mean, when I finished his book the first time, and he and I met through a mutual friend who had actually been with me at the previous publisher. So, you know, it's all interconnected. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's small world in the writing community. It really mm-hmm. is. So she had mentioned, you know, she said, would I like to look at a steampunk book? And I'm like, yes, I love steampunk. Send it to me. And I don't have this happen every time. So this is why I can brag on Rob a little bit, is because I finished that book and was ready to turn back to the first page and read it again.
Yeah. Right there. Yeah. I'd same when I read his book.
You guys.
It's Aubrey. I love Aubrey.
No, it's so true. And, yeah. And it was, you know, and obviously you have, because we're in spec fiction, we have books that are going to appeal to these people over here, and then books that are going to appeal to those people over there, and then all over the place. So we have differing levels of experience, which Rob came to us with a lot more experience. So the process was really easy for him, because I didn't have to explain a lot. It was just like, this is what I think. If he didn't agree with something, he'd send me a note back and he's like, well, I had it this way because of, and I'm like, okay, well, let's see if we can get to where you want to get, but better. Let's see if we can't smooth this out or whatever the issue was.
Yeah, that was a lot of David's notes, a lot of your notes too, but a lot of David's notes were like, this could be better. I'm like, fine, I'll write some more.
When he says this could be better, David wanted more background.
Mare and David are so great to work with. And the process is the process. It is kind of the same almost always, at least in my experience. I was orphaned from a press that went under, decided to shutter their doors and had to start hunting around again. Not to take over the conversation, but Mare and David are just so great. I just can't say enough good things. I love when we're doing the editing process. That's my favorite part of the whole process. So,
and I normally love the editing process too. You know, sometimes it's a little more difficult, especially if I'm having to explain why I'm making every note.
Right.
which I don't do with like the experienced writers like David and Rob, and we have Jordan Elizabeth is one of our writers. She's got like 40 some odd books out or something like that. Wow. And she's very easy to edit because she get all of these authors, because they've got all these books behind them, they know what they're going for, and they understand that if I make a note, the answer just doesn't come to me. So if I make a note in the manuscript that I'm questioning something, new authors will often try to explain it to me in the comment section.
Yep.
And it's like, if I've made a note about it, fix the text.
Yep.
Don't tell me what it means.
Because you don't have that opportunity. You don't have that opportunity as a writer with the reader. You don't have the opportunity to explain it to them. Oh, here's what I meant here, which means it's a failure of the author connecting with the reader.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep. At least that's how I look at it.
No, that's exactly it, which is probably why you're one of my dream authors, is just because it's so easy to work with you. And that's not taking anything away from the others, because, you know, I've got some writers that I would just kill to be able to write like them.
Yeah.
I mean, my writing is hopefully entertaining, but I know for a fact that I have writers that are just superstars, that are just, I can't even imagine being able to write with like them. Rob being one of them, David being another one, Mac Little, her book Progeny. Oh my God, that book!
So great.
Yeah, so think great. Maya yeah. Angelou and Anne Rice combined.
Oh
and,
yeah! Oh, wow.
Yeah, we should get Mac on here. Not to merit, you are great, and we really need to talk about your book. But we should get Mac on here. You will love Mac.
We can. Yeah, we'll get her. Let's reach out to her. Name a few more. I you know, part of this, what we wanted to do was spread the word about these great little indie authors that might not otherwise, you know, get a chance to get out there. So no.
Okay, but not necessarily indie, because they are with the press. So mm-hmm.
True.
They might have, like, I'm also self-published. I have my memoir out there is self-published, because obviously my press does speculative fiction. So I ran it through all the stuff, but it doesn't have the imprint.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Same thing with Apocalypse Z. When I wrote it, I wanted it to come out sooner, and I didn't feel right about cutting in line to my authors, so I self-published it, because it was just faster that way.
Yeah,
but I still had the same editing going on. I still had, you know, the same, you know, Joe Murphy is my cover artist forever. I love him dearly.
Joe's wonderful. Oh my God.
He's so wonderful to work with. He really is. And he's also a really good editor as well. So that's why I wanted to set up the three of us, because we really meld very well, where one of us is really strong. One of us might not be as strong in that area. And so it's nice to have that even across the board. Together, we just really raised the bar, I think. For a small press, I'm very proud of the work we do. We've got over, I don't know exactly how many awards we've got. I should probably count them up, but we've got a couple of. That's who else you should get. S.A. Larson, she's got two books with us. One came to us later, so we can't take credit for the awards. But it's got like 6 awards. Now these aren't the giant awards, but they are the very nice mid-level awards, like New England Book Festival.
Hey, an award's an award.
So, yeah. Well, yeah, but, you know, a little bigger is helpful, but no, they're not, you know, they don't have any Hugos or anything like that, but they've got some very, very decent mid-level awards, which we're very, very proud of. So Carrie Reed is another one. I don't know if Carrie would come on and talk, though. You'd have to ask her. she might not, but her books, it's just like another one. She's just, they just draw you in and you don't want to let them go, which is the whole point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
let's talk a little bit about your memoir with Philip K. Dick, if you don't mind, because I love your stories. I love them.
And for anybody listening who doesn't know who Philip K. Dick is, shame on you.
wow. Kari dropped the hammer.
Right? But you just never know. Philip K. Dick is the author of a book called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, among others. But Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was made into a movie called Blade Runner. And so, Mayor, tell us about that. You were friends with him, quite good friends, right, from the sounds of it.
Yeah. We were. He was probably my best friend the last 10 years of his life, and I met him when I was 19, and he moved in across the hall. The way the apartments were set up, they were set up kind of facing each other. We were on the second story. So when I say hall, it's just like this little foyer type thing. But he moved in and we all became friends, and like, it's all in the book. But it was really, I had not read science fiction before I met him. I read mysteries. I loved mysteries and fantasy. So I hadn't gotten into the sci-fi part of the speculative fiction genres. So he gives me his book that's got a short story in it. And I'm like, oh, well, this is very cool. And then he gives me his book, Ubik, which he said, you can't keep this one because it's my only copy. So I read it and I gave it back to him. And I go, yeah, this was fun. And then he started giving me his books, you know, and he'd inscribe them with cool messages. So not just sign the name, you know, I have actual messages in my books.
That is
dreamy right there. That's the stuff right there, right? Yeah. Philip K. Dick, inscribed books with personal messages because you lived across the hall from him. Yeah.
Well, I lived in the beginning, the first probably, God, I don't know, 5-6 months. Yeah. And then after that, it was just a matter of we've stayed friends, and that group also included Tim Powers, the author. Yep. Tim Powers. Yep. And James P. Blaylock was friends of theirs. He and I didn't connect as often as I did with the others in the beginning, probably because by then I was into the theater company. I was working a zillion hours. So, you know, we were keeping in touch on the phone, get together every now and then. I'd pop in and see Tim over where he worked. And that was about it. But then later, like I want to say 79, 80, Phil and I especially got in touch a lot more. Yeah. We stayed in touch, but even more so from about 79 on to when he died in 1982.
Yeah. I still love how you just rattle off these names.
Yeah.
Like the very first conversation Mayor and I ever had on the phone, because I wanted to get a feel for her. I wanted to, like, I'd had a really bad experience with a publisher. I wanted to get a good feel.
I remember that.
And she's like, you know, it'll just be a 10-minute conversation. We'll just meet and greet, 10-minute conversation, no problem. So we get on the phone and we talk for an hour. And during that, you know, Mayor goes, you know what? We're going to get Tim or Jim. Tim or Jim will give us a quote for your book. Tim or Jim. And I'm like, who are these Tim and Jim? She says them like I should know them. And then I'm like, Mayor, you don't mean James Blaylock. Oh, yeah, James, Jim. Yeah, he's a friend. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm signing with you now.
And he did.
And I did. He did. Jim did give us Jim.
we did the Philip K. Dick Festival or whatever, I can't remember what they called it, at Cal State Fullerton. Oh, gosh, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible with names, so forgive me for that. But, yeah, so we were there, and I had said to him about reading some of my stuff for my memoir, and he goes, well, yeah, but I'm going to be really honest. And I'm like, well, I would hope you did. And then he ended up giving me a really nice quote for my book. And I had several of other mutual friends that were mine and Phil's friends that also participated in that. So I was pretty comfortable asking Jim to blurb Rob's book because it was steampunk. And keep in mind, Tim Powers, James P. Blaylock, and K.W. Jeter are the three grandfathers of the steampunk genre.
Yeah.
Right.
Like so I have to pause just a little anytime their names are mentioned and bow my head a little because yeah, they are the gods of steampunk. Yeah.
Rob's doing the we're not worthy.
Exactly.
So anyway, I asked Jim, I said, look, I've got a really, really good steampunk book, and I'd love you to take a look at it. And if you like it, I'd love you to blurb it. You know.
And meanwhile, Mare's like, you know, we're gonna do this. And I'm like, there's no way James Blaylock is gonna read my book, much less blurb it. So, okay. Yeah. So that's my sense here.
So I sent him an email and he said, he was like, oh yeah, absolutely. Send it to me. So I did. And I think it was about 6 weeks.
Yeah. We didn't hear anything.
Yeah. I wasn't pushy because he told me he was really busy. He teaches college. So in between his writing, he's also teaching. So he's got a super busy schedule too. And, one of the things he said privately to me, and I think this was about Rob's book, was it's your fault my students' tests or papers or whatever aren't graded.
And Mare tells me, well, he's definitely read your book. And I'm like, I could die right then. Like, like James Blaylock has actually read my book. I don't even care if he hates it. Like, he's read it.
Any attention's good attention.
Right. Like, he loved it. And so, then, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He loved it.
And he blurbed it. And that's when I did die. I died.
Yeah. And then he told me, he said, I had no idea because I hadn't made a big issue of the press when I saw him. It was just kind of like, oh, yeah, we're doing this. And he was like, I had no idea this was the quality of work you're putting out.
Oh, nice. That's right? A great compliment.
Yeah. Because, you know, we're sitting over here in Southern Nevada. We're not in New York City. We're just a little press. We've got, like I said, 20 some odd authors. I really should probably count them. so I know. I just know it's over 20. You know? It's like, okay. I love them. They are my every one of them is got something about them that I absolutely adore. So I don't take anybody I don't like. If I think somebody's going to be a problem, I won't. I don't care if I like their book. I won't sign them because I have to have fun at this. If I'm not having fun, then what's the point?
Then there is no point.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, Jim and everything came along later. So yeah, he blurred Rob's book, and then he actually did a note to me when he sent me his responses back after I sent it to him, because Tim Powers did the forward, and then Jim sent me an email, and I wrote him back, and I said, can I use this email in my book? And he's like, sure. So I did, and then Paul M. Salmon, who did I have to look up the name of the book now, that he's got a couple books out behind the scenes of Blade Runner.
Yeah.
That he's written, and just absolutely brilliant, brilliant guy who was, you know, on the other side of the movie. Whereas I was on the Phil side, he was on the movie side of it.
Yeah.
The Ridley Scott side.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, Ridley Scott.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but Dick did not like the movie initially, right? Or he did like it, but
he hated the script.
He hated the script.
He was very cranky about Ridley Scott.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, he was. Oh my God! Yeah. I had to sit him down. Well, as much as one could sit, fell down, because he liked to pace. So he was hardly ever sitting. He's always pacing. And I was like, he's like, and they've got this guy, Ridley Scott. And I'm like, that's great. He goes, and they're going to use this other guy, Harrison Ford. Who the hell even knows who he is? And I'm like, oh my God, how can you not know who these people are? And so yeah. I'm like, you know, we need to have a come to Jesus meeting here because you do not want to blow this. But he'd already gone out and insulted Ridley in a TV Guide interview.
Yeah, it and, like very famously, like it wasn't really a common thing for an author to really like undercut the movie that was coming out. And so it like very famously was upset about Ridley Scott. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He wasn't. He didn't pull any punches.
No.
He said, well, you must be really excited to be working with Ridley Scott or something like that. And his answer is why. Yeah. The monster movie is a monster movie. And I mean, he was completely dismissive of Alien, you know, just dismissive. And I was just like, okay, you need to stop right now. you need to understand. And I finally got him calmed down enough to where he was not as bad. And then when we saw the, because he never saw the finished movie.
Oh, that was my next question.
Yeah, he never saw it. And we had a kiss and make up is what I call it. The kiss and make up meeting between him and Ridley Scott up in Hollywood. And they showed us, we toured like all the miniatures and stuff like that. Met all the people, those people, the technical people whose names, I can't remember names. I so suck. Then they showed us about 20 minutes of the special effects from the film, beginning with, you know, that opening shot that comes in over the city with all the flames coming up and everything. And Phil just turned to him at the end of that. He's like, how did you get inside my head?
Mm.
So he was very nice about it after that.
So he liked it. When he saw some of it,
he was, the special effects blew him away.
So what do you, and this, I've been dying to ask this question since I found out I was going to be interviewing you and talking about Philip K. Dick. After having, did you guys watch The Man in the High Castle?
No, he was, Phil died in 1982.
Yeah, 82, yeah.
Right. But no. I mean, did you guys watch it?
I know
he
didn't watch it.
Yeah, no, I watched a little bit of it.
Yeah. Okay.
But, and I don't even know if I read Man in the High Castle.
I never read it either. Rob, did you?
No, I haven't read it. And I want to wait until they're done, and then I want to go back and read it. But right, I have read We Can Remember For You Wholesale, which is Total Recall. And
right.
I have read, I think they're both called The Paycheck, aren't they?
I'm not sure. He's got Total Recall.
He's got a ton of films. Like Screamers is one of his.
Scanner Darkly.
Yeah, Paycheck it's the same short story. Paycheck. And
Minority
then there's also
Report.
Minority Report.
Yeah.
There's a ton of films. It's crazy how many films are based on his work.
Some brilliant work out there. The only one I have an issue with is Total Recall because they haven't done it right. They've done it twice and they haven't done it right.
They haven't
done it. Incredibly different. it's not even a little different.
Having with Philip having written all this dystopian, sort of bleak, futuristic work, what do you think he would have thought of the Trump administration?
Oh yeah.
Oh God.
especially with what happened in America this past week.
He would have been horrified. He would have just been horrified. I can't even think of what reaction he would have except for he'd get very, very depressed. He would really become a basket case, I think, if he had seen all this crap. Yeah, no, he just he would have been really unhappy about that.
Because it's almost like something out of some sort of dystopian novel, I think, just having this, what's been going on. In America. it's not a future I think anybody could have predicted. It's more, it just seems like fiction.
Exactly. And he had this sense, because he had told me that the world was going to end on April 1st in 1982.
Okay.
And we were getting ready to go to Europe for 5 to 6 weeks because he was going to be guest of honor over at the Met's science fiction convention in France, and we were going to go to England, and we were going to go a couple other places, and then we were going to end up in New York City in time for the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's like, I like, why are we making all these plans if the world is going to end on April 1st? Please explain this to me.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Legit.
Yeah. Like, well, and then I just get a glare. I would get the glare, the look, like she's doing it again. Because I was so young when I met him. I didn't know who he was. I just finished doing a show with on Ray Bradbury's world premiere for Dandelion Wine,
mm-hmm,
at Cal State Fullerton. And my roommate and I had picked Ray up in Hollywood because he didn't drive. So you had to go pick him up and schlep him down to the college. And so we did that a number of times. And, you know, so we got to hang out with him a little bit. And so I knew that name from high school. I knew Ray Bradbury, you know, required reading. So I knew that name, but I didn't know Philip K. Dick. So when he tells me he's a science fiction writer, I'm just kind of like, okay, yeah, okay.
Wow.
And oh,
Go ahead.
I was never impressed. And I think that helped keep him grounded because, mm-hmm, I started out not impressed. And even though as time went on, I actually became more impressed and I never let him know it.
Mm-hmm. No, oh my gosh, Mary, you have such great stories. Yeah. So everybody listening, you should definitely buy Relics. We didn't get to talk about it too much, but it is great. That's the World of Warcraft that the characters are based on. Everybody should go out and buy Mare's book about Philip K. Dick. That's a wonderful book. It's on my reading list for certain. I know a bunch of these stories just from talking with Mare, but definitely. And yeah, Kari, do you have any last questions for Mare?
I don't think so. It's been such a pleasure, and thanks for coming on the show.
I think we could talk with you for hours.
Well, that's a lovely compliment. Thank you so much for saying that because it means a lot.
So, Kari, if you want to mention our sponsor at this point.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you again, Mare, for coming on the show. I'd like to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Goodwin's Greenhouse Supply and Service. And Happy New Year, everybody. May 2021 be way better than 2020, that's for sure.
Fingers crossed, definitely, for 2021. Didn't start out great, but it can only get better.
That's right. And good night to everybody. And until next time, keep reading.